All right, y'all. Introducing Adam Johnson from FAIR. That's Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. And hopefully you guys follow him on Twitter. Great stuff there all the time. And at FAIR.org. Welcome back to the show, Adam. How are you, man?
How are you doing, Scott?
I'm doing good, man. Great to talk to you again. Listen, you do really great work. I always liked FAIR, even before you worked there. Always, you know, just solid media analysis. It's the inverse of the old Malcolm X quote. If you stand for nothing, you'll fall for anything. I don't always agree with where you guys are necessarily coming from on everything, but the fact that you do have principles sure does work, because you don't fall for a damn thing over there, I don't think. Even when it's, you know, in a left interest to believe a certain bad thing about the right or whatever, you guys don't fall for it. Unless it's actually true, then it's true. That's different. And so I always appreciate that about the entire organization and all of your great work there as well. Good stuff.
Hey, yeah, thanks. We're decidedly left wing, but we're not partisan. I think that's kind of the difference.
That's exactly what I'm trying to say. I'm in way too many words here. Yeah.
No, it's cool. Yeah.
All right. So listen, I want to talk to you about a few different things that you wrote here. First of all, can we talk about the 1967 war and the 50th anniversary there? You did a great little piece here at, again, FAIR.org. It's called On 50th Anniversary of Israeli Occupation, Palestinian Opinions Largely Ignored. And it's really worse than that. I remember you highlighting this on Twitter the other day, where the poor Israelis, they've been having to deal with the consequence of conquering the West Bank ever since then. That was the New York Times take on it, I guess.
Yeah, the ratio of voices that we counted was 23-2. 23 either pro-Israel or Israeli voices versus 2 Palestinian or pro-Palestinian, and then there was like 2 or 3 that were sort of in the middle, kind of ambiguous. So the coverage of the 6-day war, which was the war in which Israel, for those that don't know, captured the West Bank, which religious radicals in Israel called Judea and Samaria, and the Sinai, as well as Gaza, which is of course closer to Egypt. So they gave Sinai up to the Egyptians and then kept the West Bank and Gaza, and that's been a major source of tension. So the 50th anniversary, of which is effectively the 50th anniversary of the occupation of Palestine, the direct military occupation, as opposed to the Nakba, which was the, for lack of a better word, the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians off in certain cities and certain areas within Israel proper, is considered a day of, it's called the setback in Palestine. It's considered a major defeat for the cause of Palestinian liberation. So I just went by and looked at whose voices they were highlighting, and they highlighted the voices that supported, I guess, the more pro-Israel bent, largely because America obviously is a major ally with Israel and was instrumental to the creation of Israel. I just pointed out that I didn't think that was particularly fair. It's rare that you get the Palestinian perspective in general. It's I think more rare when you have these anniversaries, especially since it was considered good for Israel. It's considered a kind of the capturing of Jerusalem is considered, I think, by people who are more religious Zionists, considered a major victory. And obviously there's still 300,000 Palestinians still in Israel, in Jerusalem, occupied by Israel. So yeah, I don't know. It's pretty much par for course with coverage of Israel. I think the ratio of 23-2 or 23-3 is about normal. You know, you'll get the token Palestinian voice now and then. The New York Times will, I wrote an article a few months ago about the New York Times not having any pro-BDS, the campaign to boycott, divest, sanction Israel, and their coverage for, I think, 2.5 years. They had people who defended the principle of people's right to practice BDS, but not any BDS opponents. And then I think a month after we published that, they did publish a pro-BDS piece. So I don't think it was necessarily related at all, but... two and a half years is a pretty long spell. Meanwhile, of course, they have very anti-BDS writers as a matter of course. Brett Stevens, Roger Cohen, Thomas Friedman, and Nicholas Kristof. So, you know, that's, like I said, it's pretty much par for course.
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, that's really the bottom line that I want to highlight is that when it's par for the course, it's a really long course, and we've been on it for a long, long time here. And it's not just a biased narrative, right? At this point, this is straight Orwellian doublethink all the time about how the Palestinians are the subject people there, and yet somehow they're the threat. They're the conquered, they're the occupied, and yet somehow they're the terrorists. They're the ones who the Israelis have to defend themselves from all the time. And the only way that that narrative can be successful, because it's not just that it's biased, we only hear their side of the story. Their side of the story is based on a lot of serious untruths, and it's only by blocking out the Palestinians' version of the story that, like, hey, we still live here and we're under a military occupation, that they can go on. You know, it's, to me,
yeah, I mean, everything Israel does vis-a-vis the Palestinians is ripped off directly from the playbook of the United States. In the way in which white settlers in the United States dealt with native populations, it's on, I think, a longer timeline. But, you know, the idea of acting like you're negotiating peace in good faith while colonizing land is something that we, you know, my ancestors and I assume yours perfected. they do that, you know, this idea of the peace process in Israel while settlements skyrocket. At the beginning of the Obama administration, there was roughly 100,000 settlers in the West Bank. The number is almost close to 1 million now. Meanwhile, there's supposedly a peace process, which of course is a joke. The peace process and the two-state solution are marketing mantras. They're not serious things that anyone takes seriously. Palestine right now looks like you know, Swiss cheese. It's divided up with REMAX, you know, McMansions and homes that look like what you'd see in the suburbs of Phoenix or Las Vegas. They're not going anywhere. Everybody knows they're not going anywhere. And this, again, this was a similar tactic to what white settlers did for hundreds of years in the United States. Act like you're negotiating in good faith, and then meanwhile you're settling their land, and then you say, "Oh no, well, we're already here. You guys have to go." And so that's what's happening to the Palestinians, and on a maybe a slightly slower time scale, but it's what's going on. So the
I think that's a real important metaphor or analogy too, because I don't know if this is true anymore this day and age, Adam, but at least it seemed like in my lifetime, people largely regret that the Indians were treated so unfairly. I mean, yeah, of course, we had to steal the continent, et cetera. My family all came here after 1900.
Right.
But anyway, it had to be done, and too many Europeans come in and no way to stop them. But, geez, we didn't really have to give them smallpox and hunt them all down, you know, the California. Anyway, the million examples of the different Indian wars,
you know,
and some of
the
just absolute atrocities. But that's the whole thing is, if people made that metaphor a lot more often and said, yeah, exactly what's going on here is that the Israelis are basically the whites and the Palestinians are the Indians, and they're being treated absolutely unfairly, and including reservations and all these things, people might take their side, see it, because they could understand that, because they know the history of the Americas.
It's not a one-to-one comparison. There are obviously differences. Sure. Namely, that Jews were a persecuted, you know, minority in a lot of Europe, and a lot of people came to Israel. I mean, especially people that I've met went to Israel because they actually really had nowhere else to go. That was also true of America, right? It doesn't really matter. From the Palestinians' perspective, they don't really care. But it's kind of a rolls downhill thing, right? Europe hates its Jews, it kills its Jews, it purges its Jews, and then sends them off. You know, it says, oh, well, you know, they can all go to the Arab lands where you know, they themselves end up becoming the Arabs become the victim. So it's kind of a goes downhill kind of thing. And it's something that I think is part of a, you know, broader conversation, how we manage that situation. But from a media critic, from a critical media perspective, the way in which people talk about Israel and Palestine is very far removed from what's really going on there. And frankly, it's quite to the right of how the conversation takes place in Israel itself. I don't know, you know, you've had the opportunity to go there, but if you ever go to Israel, the way it's talked about there is, I think, a little bit more honest than it is here. And I think it is because you know, there's a huge contingent of Christian Zionists in this country that support Israel in a very, I think, perverse way. They support it because it's necessary for it's a necessary antecedent to the end times. I grew up in Pastor Higgy's church, John Higgy in San Antonio.
Oh, that's a whole other interview we're going to have to do sometime, my friend.
And, you know, this is very common, right? This kind of end times prophecy. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you have a very radical contingent of Christian conservatives who view Palestinians as acting, and I think Arabs in general, obviously it translates to other anti-Muslim bias, that they're sort of in the way of this prophecy and that they are sullying the purity of Jews in the state of Israel. And so, you know, there's propaganda coming from all sides. You know, a lot of people, I think the way people talk about Israel, I think, especially on, no offense, but a lot of the kind of libertarian right, for lack of a better word, I think they kind of take on a kind of tail wagging the dog mentality that Israel somehow influences America unduly. Whereas as a leftist, I take a more Chomsky model, which says that Israel's is, while it does have some undue influence in certain capacities, it's fundamentally a client state of the United States, and it's not as if Israel didn't exist, the U.S. would be this benevolent, egalitarian farming country, right? We would still be an empire.
Yeah. That's kind of the argument ad absurdum, but the real truth is it's both, right? I mean, America's an empire.
We were an empire long before there was an Israel.
Well, but that's the whole thing, right? That's why Israel has an interest in maintaining a massive influence operation inside America, is because America's an empire and they need us. In fact, Phil Weiss has great quotes from Irving Kristol and Norman Podhoretz both saying, hey, I don't care whether it's China or whether it's El Salvador or whether it's anything. Our goal is to keep America engaged in the world no matter what, so that it's available for Israel if we need it. And those are two of the major founders of the neoconservative movement. So that doesn't mean that they created the empire, but that means that they're very clear about why they're interested in maintaining it at all costs.
Yeah, I think it's a very mutually beneficial relationship for the people who are the power within those respective countries. It's not very advantageous to probably you and I, but to the U.S. war machine. I mean, for example, right?
The U.S. arms gives, dealers for sure. Yeah.
Right. I'll give you an example. Right. The U.S. gives $3.5 to $4 billion a year. There's always a supplemental package. It comes out to about $4 billion a year in arms to Israel. And people will say, oh, well, that's giving $4 billion to Israel. And that's true. And those are $4 billion in weapons that Israel doesn't have to buy. But what's oftentimes buried is that 75% of that money has to be spent on American weapons manufacturers, right, by law.
Right.
So it's both a handout to Israel and also a handout to the weapons manufacturers stateside, and all that money goes to the same, you know, three or four weapons contractors. Mm-hmm. So it's a mutually beneficial relationship that I think I don't think the tail wags the dog. At the same time, I think that it is true that there is a deep seated ideology about the longevity of Israel that does exist, I think, somewhat separate from that broader imperial framework.
Mm-hmm.
But I, you know, again, that's also exists in a lot of Christian threads as well, right?
Sure.
There was more Zionist at Cornerstone Church on a Sunday morning than there is probably in the totality of the entire county of Bear in Texas. So, right.
Well, so now back to the narrative about the occupation there, because and the Christian Zionism part of it is something that I don't pay nearly enough attention to. I guess I've done some interviews about that in the past and stuff, but I'd love to talk with you all about, especially growing up in the Cornerstone Church. That just blows my mind. Very interesting. But so just the overall thing where you grab the average American off the street, if they know anything about Israel at all, it's poor little Israel. The Muslims are always trying to kill them, and this kind of very basic sort of thing. And under that sort of basic presumption, which I believe most Americans, you know, that's basically what they think they understand about it. The BDS movement that you mentioned there, it sounds horrible. What is this whole terrible anti-Semitic thing of boycotting the Jewish country in the world? I mean, will these horrible Nazis and Islamist extremists ever leave these poor people alone? And boy, I mean, if you start with fake premise number one, then conclusion two there sounds pretty reasonable. Sounds pretty obvious, in fact, you know? I follow Roseanne Barr on Twitter. You know that's what she thinks. So,
well, yeah.
And it's again, if you beg the question, start with the false premise, then
I mean, look,
you could
most
really
people,
be stuck seeing that way, right?
most people, I mean, there's a broader Islamophobia industry that overlaps heavily with I think Zionist propaganda. You know, things like Memory are run by Israelis. Things like SITE, which is the terrorist Overwatch group, is run by a former Israeli intelligence officer named Rita Katz. Obviously Sheldon Adelson funds a lot of the terrorism monitoring groups, the one that is working with Google and Facebook. And, you know, this is why you get these kind of goofy scenarios where groups like Hezbollah are lumped in with groups like ISIS, despite, you know, that being kind of ridiculous.
Right.
And so there is I do think there's a broader interest in conflating the Palestinian liberation cause with like Muslims in general. I think this is how most Americans perceive that. When I go home and have the obligatory arguments with my conservative relatives, they don't know the difference between Sunni, Shia, Hezbollah, Hamas. They don't really care. They're all just a bunch of brown people. They're all mindlessly anti-Semitic and anti-American. And there isn't any kind of rhyme or reason to that. And the idea of a Palestinian liberation is not something or the idea of occupied Palestine is something most people don't even know.
Right.
You know, hell, I didn't know growing up, right? And until I actually went there and went to Palestine, I didn't actually have a sense of the scope of it. Because you're just not really exposed to that narrative. You're exposed to there's sort of two narratives. There's the right-wing narrative of the permanently, you know, anti-Semitic, angry Muslim who just hates Jews for the sake of hating them and has no legitimate grievance. And then there's the kind of liberal, I sort of say John Stewart narrative of they've been fighting for 5,000 years. This is a common trope you hear.
Right.
When of course that's not true. They've been fighting for 70 years, because that's when the settler colonization began. Now, of course, there was always, you know, sectarian dust ups before that. It certainly wasn't perfect, but there was certainly not this level of tension and violence until they began settling the Zionist colonies in the late 19th century, and then expedited it in the 1930s and 40s. So, you know, it's hard for people to parse. You know, people sympathize more with American, with Western Jews, European Jews, American Jews than they would with Arabs. You know, I personally have more Jewish friends and people who've gone to Israel and have relatives in Israel than I do Palestinians. So it becomes kind of abstract. You know, they speak English. You know, Palestinians mostly speak English too, but not the same way. There's not as much travel between the two countries. There's not as much. Obviously, you barely have any Palestinian voices in American media, where you do have very pro-Israel voices in U.S. media. So, it's a hard thing to really unpack because there is a lot of anti-Semitism in this world. There's a lot of, I think, anti-Semitism, frankly, in a lot of the criticisms of Israel that I think are hard to kind of divorce. Maybe not a lot, but I think it's a sizable amount. When it goes back to this tail wagging the dog theory, there's a certain point where I do think you cross from Israel's influence to a kind of, you know, the Jews are running the government way of looking at things. So, you know, as far as BDS goes, it's a hard thing to like get across to people about why people do support BDS. And of course, the reason is because they don't have any other choice. There's really no other mechanism to change Israel's behavior than BDS. The UN can't do it because they have an automatic veto with the US. Obviously, the US isn't going to really do anything other than slap their wrists every 15 years or so. There is no international mechanism. Israel, Palestine is a completely conquered and demoralized population. The PA is corrupt; it has basically no legitimacy. Hamas is basically a dead end. So, you know, they said don't promote violence. So they went the nonviolent route and decided to do an organized boycott, divestment, sanction strategy that has seen some success. I think it's seen quite a bit of success. I know that groups are coming out in support of it. It's becoming more popular for journalists and writers and pundits such as myself to openly support it. I think that I think the DSA is going to come out and support it in August, which would be good since they're kind of increasingly popular on the left. The Democratic Socialists of America, the kind of soft socialist organization that's supported Bernie Sanders.
I see. Well, listen, I want to push back on one thing that you said there. You really think there's much of a gray area between people who have an honest criticism of Israel and people who actually just hate Jews and pretend to?
I think that it can. I said there's overlap.
I'm asking how far that Venn diagram overlaps in your mind, because I mean, they seem pretty different.
Frankly, I do think that some of the criticism of Israel on the I guess the far right can't deviate to that, because I think that it's the presumption that America sort of is it's like my article about people, you know, America being drawn into war. Mm-hmm. You see this a lot with Syria, that somehow the U.S. is involved in Syria to kind of carry out the will of Israel, when of course America has its own interests that of course completely overlaps with Israel, but also it has its own ideological reasons to be there that are not. Long before there was an Israel, America was a colonial power. Maybe not long before, but you know, decades before, right? And I think that the idea that you need this grand theological pretext to be in the region is helpful, but I don't think it's essential. And obviously, there's a lot of overlap. But I do think sometimes criticism that paints Israel as being uniquely threatening. You see this also with Saudi Arabia, the kind of Michael Moore thesis he advanced in Fahrenheit 9/11, where Saudi Arabia was somehow manipulating Bush, is a kind of similarly goofy way of looking at it, I think. Mm-hmm.
The manipulation part, I'm with you there. I mean, any argument that says that, oh yeah, all of a sudden the people that run the empire in D.C. and Virginia all of a sudden aren't grown adults anymore and they don't know what they're doing, that they're just, you know, you call someone calls George Bush stupid, it's true, but don't let that acquit him. It doesn't mean he's not a premeditated evil doer. It just means that also he's really bad at it. That can be true too. And I'm reminded, for example, of the New York Times piece that was put out by the Obama White House. It wasn't some scoop. It was their version of what was going on here. And they said, well, the reason that we're helping the Saudis bomb Yemen is we got to placate the Saudis because we're doing this nuclear deal with Iran. And so they're fearful about their place in the American order in the Middle East. So we're going to do this thing for them that's really not in America's interest at all. And I think, the Americans have had their sights on the Syrians for a while. There was a time when Ehud Olmert was trying to negotiate with them and Condoleezza Rice stopped them. Right. Remember?
Yeah.
That?
I mean, let's
but
talk
on
about
the other what, hand, what, you know, what, you hear what, Michael what, Oren tell it. Boy, did Likud want to take the opportunity of 2011 to turn this into a regime change.
Oh, yeah. Of course. And of course they did. And they've been pretty explicit about their goals, especially in South Syria. Although I think their goals are probably more limited to wanting to fight Hezbollah and to get rid of Hezbollah as a safe space than to per se get rid of Assad. I think
at this point, at least. Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
I mean,
yeah.
And for the last few years, they told the New York Times, we want to see both sides lose and continue to lose.
The only meaningful threat to Israel or the United States in the Middle East is Iran. And Iran has always been the last kind of remaining meaningful challenge to U.S. hegemony in the region. And that's precisely why we're ratcheting up tensions with them. And obviously they're quote unquote proxy Hezbollah, who isn't really a direct proxy, but they're an ally. Is the closest enemy, is the only military ever to defeat Israel. It's the only meaningful threat to Israel, second to a nuclear armed Iran. So I don't know what the as far as Syria goes. I think that the end game is to prevent is the quote unquote Shia crescent from gaining more power. That's what Trump's doing now. That's what Center for American Progress said Clinton should do. It's what Clinton said she was going to do. This is one of the times where I don't think there was much meaningful difference between the two candidates. People who got duped into thinking Trump was like somehow going to be pro Russia or pro Assad, I think don't understand that like that's not the way politics works in this country. Now we have James Mattis who's his whole career has been dedicated to hating and bashing Iran. He's now killing Iranian troops and blowing up Iranian drones. And they say, oh, it's defensive. I don't think anyone really takes that seriously. So, that's where the situation's at right now in Syria. Israel is, of course, carving out its space in the Golan Heights and in southwest Syria, where they have their own kind of agenda, which is to create a kind of buffer between them and Hezbollah. And they were actually, I think, a Wall Street Journal report came out saying that they had been arming and funding rebel groups in South Syria for some time. So that was not good PR for the FSA crowd.
Yeah,
it's a bad look in that part of the world to look like a CIA stooge. It's an even worse look to look like a Mossad stooge.
Right.
It's not good for the home team, as they say.
Well, that's something we got going for us then, since Israel's been doing so much to help Al-Qaeda there, you know. All right, so now in regards to your piece here about the stumbling into war and how America always means well, and geez, this war in Syria might just start to happen to us. Now, this is something that you've been writing about for a long time. It's not just obvious. I mean, not even really covert, right? Quote, clandestine somehow. But we've all known all along since at least summer 2011, we've known for sure that the CIA was and NATO allies were intervening in Syria on behalf of the so-called revolutionaries and et cetera like that. And really, for those of us who've been watching all along, we've known this and covered it all along. And yet, it's perpetual amnesia in the media. So if they ever do report that the CIA is helping the rebels there, it's the first time ever that we've ever found this out, everybody. They say every time, over and over again, and you always try to gently remind them that, yeah, we already knew that, and we also knew this in this part, too, as far as working with our allies, Turkey and Qatar and Saudi and all of these things. And yet, as you're saying here, we have the Mattis administration outright taking it to the Syrian state. Was it three or four attacks now against Syrian state forces there?
Well, it's what it is, what they kind of generically call pro-regime forces, which is which is usually some combination of they'll say Shia militia, but usually it's the SAA and then Iranian troops or Hezbollah. I think they're deliberately vague about who it is exactly. Typically, if they say pro-regime, it usually means it's some kind of Shia fighter. Probably foreign, probably not Syrian, or probably sometimes it means the SAA, but usually it means a non-SAA militia. And I think they blew up an Iranian-made drone, and they've killed some quote unquote pro-regime forces
and shot down a Syrian jet.
Yeah, four times in the last month. They shot down a Syrian jet, which is shooting down a jet is a meaningful escalation. That's they're all saying we're sliding, drawn into war. This, of course, is part of a broader strategy that I think has been pretty obvious to anyone paying attention, which is that the U.S. wants a foothold in that region to prevent what they call a Shia corridor now, which is from Tehran to Beirut. Mm-hmm. Because obviously Iraq is majority Shia, and they're going to be they've been sort of loosely aligned with Iran. There is meaningful differences, but that's the way that the power brokers see it. Just as there's meaningful differences between Hezbollah and Iran, but they kind of paint them all with one brush, because the way, if you read American media, it appears that every Shia on earth takes their orders directly from Tehran. America wants to, they're now opening military bases in East Syria, which they're euphemistically calling Desert Outpost, which I thought was kind of cute. Again, another kind of colonial term, outpost that we're using. And then of course the SDF and our allies, they say it's like 70% Arab. I think it's probably closer to like 30%. It's mostly Kurdish forces are doing all the heavy lifting. It's to create a wedge. And so now there's a land grab, right? There's a power grab, since ISIS's days are, supposedly numbered, of who's going to fill that power vacuum, and everyone's kind of jockeying for it. And I think the U.S., there's strong elements within the Trump administration, as well as the U.S. military and pro-Israel factions who want the U.S. to be more assertive against Iran. This was, Clinton's, resistance campaign surrogate Mike Morrell, the former head of the CIA, said he thought the U.S. is one of U.S.'s jobs in Syria should be to kill Iranians and kill Russians. Yeah. This is something they use a lot of euphemistic terms. I think the term that Michael Weiss and Hassan Hassan said in the Daily Beast, they called it a U.S. protection zone, right? This is the weaponization of the kind of humanitarian pablum, mm-hmm. where the U.S. is not asserting itself to offset Iranian influence and to create a regional dominance in the region. It's to protect Syrians, right? This is kind of a very clever way of asserting American power and hegemony in the region without, under the pretext of protecting Sunni. Arabs, and this is something you see, and to some extent it is true that the Sunni Arabs have been oppressed by Shia governments. It was certainly true, although they're Alawite, but it was certainly true under the Assad government that Sunnis were disproportionately maltreated, but you know, it wasn't, certainly wasn't genocidal like what you see on from a lot of these Salafist groups, and like you see from ISIS. So the America's trying to be this, you know, present itself as this humanitarian arbiter of the Sunni Arab protection league, and of course that dovetails nicely with their broader geopolitical aims, which is to capture the land that's left by ISIS, to put it under some sort of proxy or direct control of the U.S. military, and so that's what's happening now. And so, you know, Iran and Russia have other ideas. I think, you know, Assad still wants the country back to where it was, to be a full, under complete control of the Syrian government. I think the U.S. kind of has given up on revolution for some time and are trying to do a kind of a sort of almost a sectarian partitioning. Mm-hmm. This is what's called the Lebanization of the Middle East, which is you create a bunch of highly sectarian pseudo nation states that are constantly warring with each other. It prevents a meaningful threat in the Arab world, and it also allows you can kind of play them off each other. This was obviously a tactic used by the British when they colonized places. I think that's what you're seeing now. Trump is, again, his policies are basically what the Democrats were, I think, planning to do, because they all assumed they were going to win. John Podesta had an op-ed in the Washington Post a couple days ago laying out what Trump's plan in Syria, and he actually had no meaningful criticisms of it. And there's a reason why, because Center for American Progress's plan is exactly what Trump is doing. I think they may have used more lofty humanitarian euphemisms, but effectively it's the same thing, which is to assert American power in Eastern Syria and to continue to quote unquote decimate and defeat ISIS. Mm-hmm. And so his only criticism was, you should go to Congress first, right? This is kind of the half-assed pseudo kind of criticism, right?
Which he obviously would not care about at all if he was the chief of staff in the Hillary administration.
Well, right. Now
whatsoever.
Right. And it's not even, and it's like basically go to Congress and get permission.
Hey, let me ask you this though, man,
to do this. Yeah.
You're doing, you know, as much reading as me or more here on trying to keep up with all this stuff. Has anybody said anything that makes any sense, never mind morality or anything like that, but even short-term sense about who they think is going to rule Raqqa? Because, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, there's no indication that the YPG Kurds want to take over that city and try to rule it. They'd have to kick all the Sunni Arabs out of it to try to take control of the thing. They don't have any interest in doing that. So who the hell they think is going to take it over? Do you know?
It would be some sort of, I think, NATO surrogate.
The Marines. I mean, yeah.
Well, they'll just rebrand one of these like Islamist light groups.
You know what's
like
funny
did,
too is
like they did in Libya.
You go back to 2012, just 5 years ago, Obama told, right around this time, Obama told Jeffrey Goldberg, that's right, Jeffrey Goldberg, the reason we want to do this is to take Iran down a peg, since George Bush helped give their proxies and friends Baghdad, you know, consolation prize, I'm paraphrasing, consolation prize, we can take Assad out of the chain of Iranian influence in the region, or at least, you know, weaken them, etc. And yet, all they did, so that was really the motivation behind the whole movement to support the insurgency, which I don't want to overstate it. I don't need to. People can connect whichever dots and whichever pattern they like. But it's certainly, as Hillary Clinton herself predicted on February 28th, 2012, to CBS News, right? We don't want to accidentally give space and be, you know, in essence, de facto allies of al-Qaeda if they're supporting the war in Syria. Well, that's exactly what they did. And everybody says ISIS, ISIS, ISIS. But ISIS is just the Iraqi-dominated faction of al-Qaeda in Iraq, whereas al-Nusra is the Syrian-dominated faction of al-Qaeda in Iraq. The worst part, the Zarqawiite part of the insurgency from Iraq War II. And so Obama was the one who gave them the ability overall, him and his allies and their policy, to create the Islamic State in eastern Syria and then eventually even into western Iraq. And what you're talking about now, that here come the Shia, well, what are they doing? They're only now correcting that. So just like George Bush brought Shiite power you know, 20 miles west and given them all of Baghdad in Iraq War II. Now Obama's just given them a reason, basically, to take all of Ramadi, Fallujah, Mosul, and expand the borders of Shiistan further west. Certainly their power and influence Shia west. And now here we are in 2017 talking about, so now what are they going to do? Now are they going to leave the Marines in Raqqa? Are they going to try to work out a thing with the Kurds? Because somehow they got to limit Iraqi and, quote, Iranian Shiite power from moving any further west than the old Durand line now. I mean, I'm sorry, Durand line, I'm in Afghanistan. The old Sykes-Picot line.
Yeah, I mean, what the broader aims of the U.S. military is outside of my pay grade. I think that there are certainly common threads which are pretty out in the open, from Cap to Brookings to what the president says, which is that the U.S.'s goal is to offset what they consider to be Iranian influence in the region. That to me seems to be like the overarching animating factor behind this entire thing. How specifically what the exact strategy is, I don't know, nor do I claim to know. What I write about is that the media makes broad assumptions about America not having a plan and kind of bumbling around in good faith. So I'm not the one making an assertion as to what the overarching organizing model is. It's the media that does it all the time. So in my piece, I write about how they say America is getting sucked into a Middle East quagmire. They're getting Vice said they're America's getting trapped into endless conflict. Brookings said we're sliding into war. These terms imply a degree of benevolence and incompetence that I don't think is really accurate. I believe the term that was used by the descriptor that was used by The Atlantic was, even as Washington potentially stumbles into war. It assumes that there isn't any kind of larger geopolitical aims in the region, which is, I think, absurd. Of course there is, and I know this because they're pretty much spelled out. So I think these terms that strip the United States of, for lack of a better word, agency, and strip them of designs are a very, very subtle but very effective propaganda technique that journalists have internalized, because they believe that the U.S. So there's two things, right? There's one side that flatters the right wing, which is this idea that America is benevolent and it only goes to war reluctantly. Mm-hmm. And then there's a kind of thread, what I sort of call the nominal lefty thread, which is that America is actually incompetent, right? They're actually boobish. And you see these people, they'll read Legacy of Ashes or they'll read Ghost Wars, and they come away thinking, oh, the CIA is just a bunch of dipshits. And it kind of flatters our sensibility that America doesn't know what they're doing. It's kind of like a hipster liberal belief that America became the greatest empire on earth by accident. And I think that's an incredibly dubious leap to make. While I think that's true in some kind of micro sense, I think generally speaking, the US is actually incredibly good at what it does, because they assume its nominal goal is its actual goal. And I think that's a huge assumption that isn't really historically justified. People say, oh, well, the aftermath of Iraq was a shit show, and the aftermath of Libya was a shit show, therefore America's incompetent. But you're presupposing that America really gave a shit about building a stable democracy in these countries. And I think that's a huge assumption. And I think it's one that assumes benevolence on the part of U.S. policymakers that I see no historical evidence for.
Yeah. Well, I come up against this all the time because, occasionally people interview me and I try to explain that, why did Bush do so much to enhance Iranian and Shiite power in Iraq? The answer to that is because he's stupid. Because him and Paul Wolfowitz and Richard Perle are stupid. And what they did was absolutely an own goal. It doesn't mean that they meant
that's not,
well.
I don't think that's true. I think it's simple. It's the objective is to get rid of those who could meaningfully threaten U.S. hegemony. That's the only through line. The sectarianism is irrelevant to them. They'll do a kind of Kissinger balancing act thing, but ultimately it doesn't really matter. Saddam Hussein was he had his own, he potentially had a chemical weapons program. He may have had a nuclear program 10, 15 years down the line. He was a rogue agent. He was a threat to American hegemony, so he had to be taken out. The fact that the Shia were going to fill the gap was simply, that's how it had to happen, right? And then Gaddafi was the same thing. Gaddafi was a threat to U.S. hegemony. They saw an opportunity to take him out, so they took him out. Now, of course, before that, they were trying to work with him, but that's the way these things work, right? It's a carrot and stick thing. You have these neoliberal reforms. If you accept them and you submit to the sort of American way of doing things, then you're allowed. But the idea that somehow they boobishly overthrew Saddam, I think, is not correct, because the the atomic unit is regime change. The atomic unit
is the point I was complaining about, though. How come if they're stupid, that makes them a boob? And why does that, or in other words, if they're stupid, why does that imply any kind of innocence or less criminal culpability on their part? In other words, you could have a premeditated murder plot that you plan to rob a guy's house and you're going to kill him and his family, but you end up getting your own family's house burned down and they all die in that too. So you're a stupid idiot who shouldn't have done that. Doesn't mean that you're not guilty of being a horrible premeditated murderer also. It's just that there's blowback sometimes.
If one views the primary goal of U.S. policy decision-making in the Middle East as the elimination of existential threats, e.g. nuclear or chemical or a meaningful air force, then absolutely things have gone pretty damn well. There really is only one meaningful threat left in the Middle East, and that's Iran. And by through extension, Hezbollah. That's it. 15 years ago, you had Iraq, you had Iran, you had Libya. Now you basically have one country. It's not some perfectly slick executed conspiracy, but it seems pretty simple to me. You eliminate threats. There's nothing subversive at all about ISIS to the ruling class of this country. 40,000 guys running around in a
That's not my evidence of failure, though. The evidence of failure to me is not ISIS. The evidence of failure to me is Maliki saying to Bush, "Now get the hell out of my country." He wanted 56 bases, and the Iranian backed government. Basically, it was a race between the Americans and the Iranians for who was going to have the most influence over the government that America put in power. And the Iranians won, and they kicked Bush out.
It's not a perfect science. I'm not saying they're not like the bad guys in 24. They don't sit around, coming up with grand conspiracies. But broadly speaking, if your criteria at the very least is to get rid of meaningful threats, I think it's gone pretty damn well. I think, what arises in there in that place is debatable. But look, America will have its military bases in Iraq. They're going to be staying there for decades as it looks now. We're going to have military bases in Afghanistan probably when my kids' kids graduate high school. I don't think that war is designed to ever really end, which is maybe I shouldn't be calling it a war. I mean, I don't know how many decades have to pass before you just call it an occupation. But there isn't some master plan that's executed perfectly, but I think the general thrust of eliminating enemies and now the remaining enemy is Iran, and that's who we're shooting right now in Syria. That seems reasonable to me. I don't think anyone's dumb enough to ever try regime change in Iran, because unlike Iraq, they really don't have sectarianism you can divide and conquer. They're also very battle hardened, and the government there, I'm sorry to say, is generally very popular, especially if they were under attack by the US or Israel. They would completely hand our ass to us. I don't think anyone really disputes that. They lost a million people in the Iraq-Iran war, which they still blame us for. And they would probably, it's a world war. We're talking World War One type war. People literally just droves and droves of people going in to fight the Iraqis in trench warfare, and they did it, and they're very prideful about that. They consider that something to be a great point of pride. And so, the point is to put pressure on Iran, it's to put them in other ways. Whether it's sanctioning, whether it's killing their proxies, whether it's blowing up their drones, I think there's certainly a containment philosophy that's taking place right now. And again, this is not secret. It's the express policy of the Department of Defense. And that's what you're seeing. So do I think that these attacks against Iranian or pro-Iranian targets in the past month by Trump have been accidents or rather self-defense? I don't think so. I think they're trying to let them know that they're not fucking around, and they'll kill them if they have to. So that, once you cross the threshold to bombing a country, it's at that point, it's a formality, right? This is why the bombing on April 6th was so big, because it crossed the threshold of formally bombing Syria. Now, of course, we've been bombing the Syrian territory for 2.5 years and killed thousands and thousands of people. But that was a scope creep to bombing the government directly, which has sort of long been the underlying objective, I think, for a lot of people within the CIA and State Department. The military is a little different, though. The Defense Department, from my reading, is kind of split. I don't think the DOD actually wants to overthrow Assad and have to clean up the mess, but I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it seemed like they've been more content to back the Kurds, where the CIA wanted to keep backing the Friends of Sawahiri over there.
Yeah, I think they literally just kind of ran out of any pretext of moderate rebels. I think it's probably true that in 2012 there was a sizable contingent of you know, non-sectarian, non-Salafi rebels, and I think that it just got to the point where you couldn't even really fake it anymore a couple years ago.
Yeah. Well, you know, even when John McCain went and met with the Northern Storm Brigade, at that time, there was already a Time magazine interview of the leader of the Northern Storm Brigade saying, yeah, I'm a veteran of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. I fought the Americans in Iraq War II. That's
it's messy because, you know, it's not, you know, I don't like to adopt this kind of war on terror language because I don't think it's very helpful. And it is true that there, you know, there are people who did join Nusra who aren't these kind of cartoon, you know, head chopping terrorists. And I don't want to act like I don't want to channel Michael Weiss here, but like, you know, I met people whose family was tortured by the Assad government, or they, you know, were disaffected from the Assad government, and it had frankly had nowhere else to go but some of these, you know, dodgier groups. So in a personal level, I don't necessarily blame that necessarily, but the question is, where is the money coming from, right? Where are the sources coming from? They're coming from Saudi Arabia. They come from Qatar, and Saudi Arabia and Qatar don't care about democracy and don't care about secularism. They want to seed sectarian tension. They want to kill what they view as their sectarian enemies. And that's, you know, because I met people. I'm by no means an expert on the region, but I did spend 6 months in Beirut, and Beirut has a lot of Syrians there. And you'd meet Syrians who say, you know, I support, this is obviously anecdotal, so take it for what it's worth, but I support the revolution, or I support the overthrow of Assad, but I blame the Saudis for corrupting or polluting the peaceful revolution. This is something I heard more than once. So it's, you know, it's not simple. It's a total shit show. It's a mess. And the people that are suffering the most are the ones who don't, you know, who aren't writing the checks, who aren't making these huge arms deals, who aren't sitting behind a desk somewhere and Langley and coming up with designs for Syria, or sitting in, you know, Riyadh and running, you know, running the calls out of there. And that's the big shame about this war, is that the people who were most affected by it have basically little control.
Well, you know, I just ran a great article on, and there are numerous articles really like this along these lines, and probably some books too that I'm not up on. But I ran a great article on my website at the Libertarian Institute by a guy who talked about a lot of the quite large peaceful protests in 2011 and even in 2012, where there were a lot of people. But the thing is, there were jihadis would show up too and start killing cops. And it was getting worse and worse like that. And the Americans and their, as you say, the Saudis and Qataris had no interest in having a solution to that problem anyway. But the Americans really had no way of intervening to help the revolution without helping those guys. Again, that Hillary Clinton interview with CBS News, where the questioner, the CBS reporter, is being the hawk, and he's saying to Hillary Clinton, why aren't you doing more? And she says, well, look, and we know now the email is there from a week before where her aide says,
right,
to her, hey, look, boss, AQ is on our side in this one. She's referring to that email pretty plainly, right? And she says, well, you know, Ayman al-Zawahiri has endorsed this revolution, so are we supporting al-Qaeda in Syria? So she's being rhetorical. I'm not trying to be too kooky about that or anything, but I'm saying she was recognizing that, geez, if we're helping overthrow Assad, we're kind of helping the butcher New York City, and that might be a problem.
Yeah.
But then she kept pushing for it anyway.
I mean, look, the degree to which the reality is, we have no idea what the CIA has or hasn't done in Syria. It's a total black hole. There's basically no reporting on it. We have a number, which is roughly $1 billion a year, that the Washington Post arrived at by cross-referencing a DOD source with a Snowden document from 2013. Now, I assume that $1 billion a year wasn't spent on lunch spreads and Wi-Fi. I assume it probably was used for to arm and fund groups. How many, we don't know. The Washington Post puts it at 10,000. For that program alone, I don't know. I don't claim to know the extent to which the CIA was involved. You know, a lot of people on the pro-revolution side say the CIA didn't do anything or that they were negligible. I find that a bit dubious. But even if you grant that, what I argue is that the media, or what I've always argued is that the media has completely whitewashed or ignored that fact entirely. I don't think we should all sit around and speculate the extent to which they're involved, but I also think it's malpractice intellectually, and I think on a moral level, to completely ignore the U.S.'s role in that conflict. And you see it time and time and time and time and time again. Right. It's an exceedingly convenient narrative because it assumes that America just stood by and did nothing, when of course the opposite is true. And you're seeing that again now, right? That we're not sure what the U.S.'s goal is, what's their agenda. I mean, look, their agenda has been the same. It's to offset Iranian influence in Syria. It's really not complicated.
Part of it is too that back in Iraq War II, they never said who was who at all. They would only ever say, well, so America is helping the people of Iraq defend themselves from the terrorists who are trying to thwart their freedom and democracy. Well, that's never really said, oh, Zarqawi bad and Sadr bad, but not really why, other than they're resisting. But they never gave the context. And so then the entire aftermath of this thing, nobody really seems to understand who's who or why anybody's doing anything in it, you know, including the people whose job it is to explain it all to us in the news. It never mind the fact, as you're talking about, their interest in being so short in memory here, but they never really learned it in the first place themselves.
Well, what they advance is a very like moralistic narrative, right? You see, it's obligatory. You see it, right? Assad the butcher, the murderous dictator, bloody dictator, murderous bloody dictator, dictator bloody dictator, and you sort of say it enough, and it's like, okay, obviously Assad's killed a lot of people. Obviously he, forget the body count. We'll just talk about the practice of torture alone. It's pretty, you know, it's pretty extensive. They did run a very sophisticated police state, and so you have this kind of like moral non-starter with Assad staying in power. The problem was and will always be, which is, okay, let's assume that he dies of a heart attack tomorrow. Where does that leave us? And the nominal goals of the rebels, even the supposed moderate rebels, has always been the complete overthrow of the system of government of Syria, not just one person, but the estate as such, which of course is the whole Ba'athist system, however you define it. So even if Assad dies tomorrow for whatever reason, nothing really changes. And one of the problems is that no one who supports that has to really come up with an alternative. They can just say, oh, well, he's evil, therefore, anything's better than him.
Yeah.
And maybe that's true, but, you still have all your work ahead of you, which is okay, well, what does that look like? And the reality is there's only one option, which is effectively a NATO-run government, sort of like similar to what you saw in Libya, right? Where you have a kind of provincial government that relies entirely on a confederation of Western powers. And I assume that's always been the goal. Mm-hmm. It's been the goal since the first blueprints were written up by Michael Weiss in Foreign Policy. The goal was to create a kind of NATO vassal state that was, probably more democratic in some ways, to be fair, but was not independent of the U.S. Broader military apparatus within that region. So I think there's maybe attempts to kind of create, to partition Eastern Syria to create that. So we'll see. But again, the cartoon narrative that the media continually propagates promulgates, I think, is incredibly removed from reality. And I think the discourse has shifted. I think people kind of are more open about that in the last year or two. I think that wasn't always the case, because I think people kind of see that it doesn't quite add up to as simple a picture as they make it out to be.
Right. Hey, let me ask you one more thing before I let you go here. And I'm sorry I've kept you so long, Adam, but no, if anybody knows the answer to this, you might be the guy there. Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. You guys are absolutely meticulous. But I saw a Republican, I'm almost certain, congressman say on TV in 2013. Sorry, I know I'm being very vague, but it's a pretty specific quote. The CNN reporter or whoever it was, TV cable news reporter, said, well, so, once they get rid of Assad, well, then, so who's going to be the government after that? And the congressman says, well, you know, we just hope that someone will come to the fore. And I just thought that was the perfect answer, right? Like, well, whatever. It'll probably work out.
Yeah, I mean, that's
good. Did you hear that one? Do you know what I mean?
Because, again, the atomic unit is regime change.
Yeah.
And what comes after that doesn't really matter to them. Like,
Yeah, it's the just an excuse unquote, for a further war.
This is why the like.
But do you know who it was that said that? Come to the fore. Do you remember?
I don't. I'm sorry.
Ah.
This is why the liberals who say, oh, the war was good, but the aftermath was badly planned, are the world's kind of, I think, most disingenuous people, or they're total idiots. Because the reason why the aftermath, quote unquote, is always a shit show, and it always is because nobody fucking cares. It's baked into the cake. They don't actually care about the aftermath because that's not the objective. The objective is to remove someone who threatens your power. Now, if the aftermath is you know, Athenian democracy, then great. If it's not, who gives a shit? There's no incentive for anyone to really care about the quote unquote aftermath. I mean, just pure dollars alone. One statistic I use that is that the United States gives more aid to Israel every year than it does the last seven countries we bombed combined. So that's how much we care about the people, the countries that we bomb, and the leaders we dislodge.
Right. All right. Good times, man. Thanks for coming back on the show, Adam. Good interview.
Sure. You got it.
I appreciate it.
Later.
All right, you guys. That's Adam Johnson. He does great work there at Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. Check him out at fair.org. This one is the 50th anniversary of Israeli occupation. Palestinian opinions largely ignored. And Syria, the latest case of U.S. stumbling into war.